My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFTA's Board of Directors, Associate Station Manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Ed McManus of McManus Consulting and author of Ed's newsletter. But first, disability news for the week of January 11th, 2021. An important program for people with disabilities who want to live in their own homes has been renewed for 3 years under legislation approved in late December. Money Follows the Person gives states extra funds to provide employment, housing, and other services to help people transition from nursing homes and other institutions to homes in the community. The development caps off some tough years for the program. Money Follows the Person officially expired in 2016, and Congress has approved 8 extensions, including one that was only 7 days, to keep it alive since then. However, the doubt led many states to stop making transitions and end their programs as money ran out. The renewal, which came as part of a broader government spending bill, should bring stability to the program by committing $450 million annually to the program through September of 2023. Legislators also included changes to allow all states to take part and to shorten the time a person would have to stay in an institution before they qualify to transition to community. From 90 days to 60 days, according to Nicole Jorwick, Senior Director of Public Policy at the ARC. Jorwick said, quote, "While we were pushing for permanence, 3 years of funding available to all states, not just those with existing programs, will be very helpful in the face of the pandemic to move people with disabilities out of large congregate settings like nursing homes and institutions and back into their homes and communities," end quote. A recent report from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services shows that between 2008 and 2019, Money Follows the Person helped more than 100,000 people leave institutions for community-based settings. Besides renewing Money Follows the Person, the federal spending bill also increased funding for special education by $186 million, allocated $25 million extra for housing for people with disabilities, and added $35 million for the administration on community living, among other changes for the 2021 fiscal year. For decades, many experts believed that autism could not reliably be diagnosed in children until after the age of 2. Now researchers say that a simple routine test may detect autism in newborn children. Tests regularly given to newborns to screen for hearing loss could also offer clues about whether they are on the spectrum, according to a new study. The test measures a child's auditory brainstem response, or ABR, to determine how the inner ear and brain react to sounds. For the study, researchers examined nearly 140,000 auditory recordings from children and matched them with the state's educational records. They found that kids later diagnosed with autism showed slower brain responses during the infant hearing tests. Elizabeth Simpson is an associate professor at the University of Miami who worked on the study, published recently in the journal Autism Research. According to Simpson, quote, "We're not at the point just yet where we're telling clinicians to use ABR testing as a determinant for autism in babies, but we are saying that this study presents a promising direction in how ABR testing can be used as a method for precise autism detection at birth," end quote. Simpson said that children with autism may process sound differently even if their hearing is normal, so researchers are considering how adding more elements to the auditory screening could better determine a child's risk for autism or other developmental issues. Said Oren Myron, a research associate at Harvard Medical School who led the study, quote, "The importance for diagnosing autism early during infant and child development when interventions can have the most impact cannot be overstated. Any additional tool that could clarify diagnostic clues would be invaluable in that regard," end quote. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has added Down syndrome to a list of other conditions they say put people at higher risk of severe illness if they contract COVID-19. That makes Down syndrome one of a dozen conditions, including cancer, chronic kidney disease, obesity, and pregnancy, that the CDC specifically warns have been linked to an increased risk from the virus. The agency also maintains a separate list of conditions that might be at increased risk for severe illness from the virus that causes COVID-19. The CDC said that the addition of Down syndrome to the increased risk list came in response to recent data. People with Down syndrome or their caregivers should talk to their healthcare provider about their individual risk, considering their medical history and the situation in their community, the agency said. Research published in the fall found that people with Down syndrome were 4 times more likely than others to be hospitalized due to COVID-19 and 10 times more likely to die from the virus. A handful of other studies in recent months have provided additional evidence that individuals with Down syndrome and other developmental disabilities face a higher risk of death from COVID-19. As a result, disability advocates have been pushing states to prioritize people with developmental disabilities in their vaccine distribution plans, but a December report found that only 10 states had specifically addressed those with developmental disabilities in their plans. And finally, the U.S. Department of Justice says the Iowa Department of Human Services and staff at an Iowa facility violated students' 14th Amendment rights by providing inadequate care and experimenting on them without their knowledge or consent. It is alleged that the state of Iowa has subjected residents to unreasonable harm and risk of harm in violation of their 14th Amendment rights by exposing them to uncontrolled and unsupervised physical and behavioral experimentation, inadequate physical and behavioral health care, and inadequate protections from harm, including deficient safety and oversight mechanisms, according to a report DHS released in late December. The 14th Amendment says the government can't deprive any American of life, liberty, or property without due process. The DOJ continues to investigate whether the Glenwood Resource Center, the center in question, has violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. The federal probe, which started in 2019, resulted in the firing of Jerry Ray as superintendent. Former residents have alleged in a federal lawsuit that Ray used residents in sexual arousal experiments without their permission. The report includes 4 pages of remedies that the Justice Department says it will work with the DHS to implement. And that's the news for this week.
We are called to help our friends in need. You can count on me like 1, 2, 3. I'll be there. Are supposed to do, oh yeah.
And you are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today on the phone by Ed McManus, who has been on the program a couple of other times as a great expert in the field, knows a lot about the state of Illinois, and is currently a consultant with McManus Consulting, working with lots of agencies and families. So welcome to the program, Ed.
Thank you.
So why don't you fill in the blanks here and give a little bit more detail about who you are to the listeners out there.
Sure. Thanks, Vicki. I appreciate your inviting me. I worked for the Department of Human Services for many years, and I retired 10 years ago and set up a consulting practice, and now I do a lot of consulting. It's keeping me out of trouble now that I'm retired, and it's a great way to spend my retirement. So I consult with various provider agencies, and I also take a lot of phone calls from families who are confused by how our disability system works in Illinois. And I got into all this because I have a daughter who is now in her 40s, and she has a severe disability. Her name is Laura. And so my wife and I have been very involved ever since Laura came along.
And how is the family doing during COVID? Are you all okay, doing well?
My wife Ellen and I live in a condo in Wilmette, and we are very fortunate that our daughter Laura just lives a few blocks away from us. And I know that certainly a lot of families don't have that privilege, and they have to be distant from their family members. But Laura is in a Scylla group home, and a very small one, and we see a lot of her. In fact, I just was over there earlier today.
That's great news. So I want you to just tell the listeners about the big things that are going on that they need to know about. So what's at the top of your list?
Well, before I get into that, I wanted to touch on something that you had asked me about. It has to do with the home-based program. So for those listeners who are not familiar with the system, the Illinois system for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities has two main programs. One of them we call CILA, which is Community Integrated Living Arrangement, CILA. And those are the group homes throughout the state that provide residential services for people. The other is the home-based services program, and that's for people who are living at home and who choose not to move into a group home, but either live with their families or in some cases live on their own if they're capable of doing that. And then they are able to access, hold on a minute. I have a recurring cough, so I apologize. The home-based program is very flexible, and the individuals that are in it are able to access whatever services they need. A lot of them attend day programs, and they also, in many cases, have personal support workers coming in to assist the family in caring for them. The specific question that you had asked had to do with vaccination, and of course, this is on everybody's mind these days. In fact, my wife and I are pretty elderly, so I guess we're going to be at the top of the list, and we're not going to complain about that. We're looking forward to getting vaccinated. There's been various questions with regard to both individuals with disabilities and staff as to what their priority will be for the vaccination. And I just found out this afternoon that the staff of the group homes are definitely given top priority. And the residents of the group homes are given top priority. And what we call the personal support workers that I referred to that work in the home-based program are also considered frontline healthcare workers. And they are therefore in, they call that priority group 1A. Mm-hmm. And so right now, the only people that are getting vaccinations are people in 1A. the next category will be 1B, which would include people like my wife and I who are elderly, who are over the age of 65. And so it's quite a challenge for the Department of Public Health and the local county health departments to manage all this, but and they've been putting out various bulletins And so this is the latest one, and it just came out this afternoon, and I think we're all going to be very happy to hear that, you know, like, for instance, my daughter will be eligible to be vaccinated, and the staff that take care of her will be eligible. And if my daughter was living with us, she would be eligible. So those are the main categories at the moment.
Right. So as more information comes available on that, you know, we certainly will share that with listeners as we proceed through this very, very difficult time. And hey, congratulations on being next in line, because there got to be some perks for getting old, right?
Yeah, that's right. I love it. So I just a few days ago put out a special edition of my newsletter, which I send out all over the state approximately once a month, just to keep people up to date on what's going on in the field of the disabilities, and specifically intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
What I do every year is look back at the previous year and kind of give a summary of the highlights, and I'd like to share that with your listeners, and then I'd also like to talk about what my priorities are for the future for the Department of Human Services. Certainly the biggest thing that happened this year was the coronavirus, which affected us all, but it affected folks with disabilities in an even greater way. And our entire day program, which is called Community Day Services, was shut down in March. And so that meant that all of the folks, such as my daughter, who were attending day programs, all of a sudden were stuck at home and were not able to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for months and months. And then it was finally decided to reopen it in September. But an awful lot of people didn't come back, and it was either because the families were concerned about their family members being in a congregate setting, or the agencies operating the group homes were reluctant to send them back. And so, believe it or not, 70% of the people who were enrolled last spring did not come back in September. Only 30% came back, and in the case of the people in the group homes, the Department of Human Services has arranged for them to be reimbursed for providing services in the home to all those individuals who are staying in their homes. And in the case of the home-based program, those folks are no longer able to access, or take that back. They are able to access it now, but they're choosing not to. And for those people, they can have more of the personal support workers coming in to help them, because they will have that extra money available.
Right.
So it's been quite a year. And then in our institutional system, you know, we have seven big state institutions serving 1,600 people, and they have had quite an outbreak of coronavirus, and it's resulted in a total of 16 residents and staff dying over the last few months. We had a very big event in the spring with regard to the to our independent service coordination system, the ISCs. The Auditor General issued a report that was highly critical of the way the department had gone about restructuring the system. We dealt with the legislature, as we always do, asking for more money, and the legislature did approve a $1.50 per hour rate increase.
Which is not nearly enough, but...
Not nearly. And so, you know, those are some of the highlights of the year. And And then I have listed in my newsletter what I think are the priorities. And Vicki, I'll tell you that they're the same priorities that they were last year and the year before, because we still, you know, Illinois is still way behind the rest of the nation in its support for people with disabilities. So, in my opinion, the biggest thing the department needs to do is to do something about these big institutions. They're costing us a fortune, and it's just, you know, in addition to the cost, it's just not right, in the opinion of a lot of us, for people with disabilities to have to be locked up in an institution instead of being able to live in the community. So we would really love to see Governor Pritzker take that on and shut down at least one or two of the institutions. Secondly, we continue to be 47th in the country in the amount of money that we provide for disability services.
And I think that means we went up a couple notches then, didn't we?
No, it's been 47th for 3 or 4 years,
yeah.
I think. But sometimes we say, thank God for Mississippi, or we'd be last. But it's really embarrassing to have to admit that we are so low in our support for disabilities, and that's just been going on forever, and the legislature and the governor needs to do something about it. They need to prioritize our services. And number three is that our group homes, the largest number of group homes are 8-person homes, and that's just an awfully large house. Again, the people with disabilities deserve to be able to live in smaller houses. The national average is only 3 persons per home, and our average is 8 persons. So, you know, there are some of these things that just continue to disturb us. But we haven't given up. We're urging all of our members and our readers to contact their legislators and see if they can do something about it. Of course, we know that Illinois doesn't have a lot of money these days. It seems like they never have had a lot of money for us. They have enough money to build highways and so forth, but we get short shrift. So we are hoping that the legislature will be more responsive to our field.
Well, let's hope so. It has been a very long time since there's been much attention paid. And my big worry is that with the coronavirus situation, that they're going to be focused on that and not necessarily on what positive changes they can make that will help people with disabilities have less exposure to the virus.
Well, it's certainly true that dealing with the virus has been very expensive for the state government, and so they've spent a lot of money that if it weren't for the virus, they could have spent on our programs. And so, you know, we realize that's the reality that the legislators, I don't envy the job of the legislators or the governor either, because they've got lots of organizations beating down their doors saying my issue is the most important, but somehow our folks with disabilities and the advocates that work for them need to get that message across. And I also think that the governor was hoping to get this constitutional amendment passed for a graduated income tax. That would have made a big difference in terms of the money, but that was defeated by the voters in November. So,
right.
So we're not holding our breath, but nevertheless, we are, you know, continuing to advocate with both the governor and the legislators to pay attention to us, to do something about this.
Do you think that there's a possibility the legislature might increase the graduated, or not the graduated, the flat tax rate at this point? And
we're stuck with the flat tax. It was a controversial issue. I happen to think the graduated was a great idea, but it didn't get the votes. And so the reality is that folks are, you know, that the legislature doesn't have much choice other than to increase taxes, and that's not a very popular thing to do. But I think that within reason, we can expect to see an increase in taxes. But, you know, with all the expenses of the dealing with the virus, it's just going to make their job all the harder.
Right. Well, you know, the coronavirus has changed almost everyone's life. And I'm just wondering, in your work and working with agencies all over the state, what have you seen in what they're doing differently that you have not seen before?
Well, you know, the biggest change is simply that for the residential programs, the individuals are all staying home, and so it's really hard on them because those folks want to get out and go to their day programs and see their friends and get a little fresh air, and instead, just like you and I, they're stuck in their house all day.
Mm-hmm.
And and then meanwhile, the day programs, particularly the ones that are not tied to a residential facility, they're really hurting because, I mean, they're really losing big money, and some of them may go out of business. It's really pretty scary for them.
Right, because they only get paid if they're actually serving people and it's on an individual basis, right?
That's right. There has been some subsidies going to them, but it hasn't been nearly enough. And I'm very worried about it. And I have five agencies that are clients of mine who are in that category. They're what we call a standalone day program. They do wonderful work, but they don't have a residential. The agencies that have residential are in a little bit better shape because they can kind of, they're getting enough revenue through the residential that they can make up for the fact that they're not getting it through the day program. But that's something that is of great concern, and I think that the Division of DD certainly is aware of that and is trying to do whatever they can. But a lot of people are pretty worried about what the future of the day program system is going to be.
Yeah, might be time to start looking for jobs for people. But that job market's really tough right now, too. So I don't know. So, Ed, before we're done, why don't you give folks information about how they can sign up for your newsletter, get in touch with you, whatever you think is important for them to know?
Sure. I am on Facebook, and I'm also on LinkedIn. So anybody wants to go to either Ed McManus on LinkedIn or McManus Consulting on Facebook can read my newsletters as they come out. And certainly anybody who, any family who has a question or needs some, I don't charge families, I charge the agencies. I mm-hmm. make some money with them, but with the families, I take a lot of phone calls. If people want to write down my number, it's 847-256-0456. I'll repeat that, 847-256-0456. So I'm more than happy to talk to people. And like as you may be able to tell from my voice, I love what I'm doing, and it's a great way to retire.
That's great. That's a great time talking to you, Ed. Thanks so much for joining us today. Ed McManus of McManus Consulting.
Thank you.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
stay.